had costume, we had a set. The whole set was kind of like iridescent pink and pink fur.
Oh, wow.
And pink feathers.
Yes.
It was so beautiful.
Welcome to Sex, Power, Money with me, Sarah Pascoe. Today I'm talking to Joanna Nastori, a Brazilian-British actor, poet, writer and community organiser. She created the multi-award-winning theatre show Fuck You, Pay Me, a love letter to strippers which I saw at the Edinburgh Festival last year and it absolutely blew me away. Today we're going to be talking about the rights of workers under capitalism, art, the role of the artist and the similarities between comedy and stripping.
Got to do a wider reach out, so lots of people who hadn't got to see it came to see it.
Yes.
And I met loads and loads of people who had previously worked as strippers or sex workers or were currently in the industry.
Yes.
And I would have conversations with people every day after the show.
That's brilliant.
And that was really a joy for me personally.
So those people from the industry, as you say, they must so rarely see a truthful depiction of their experience. So regardless even of themselves, in kind of mainstream media, there's lots of tropes around all kinds of jobs and all kinds of people, but definitely with strippers and sex workers, people don't see. One of the things I really love from your show was hearing you playing all of the customers and the very cliche things that people say, but essentially on every night there's a similar type of, what's a nice girl like you doing here? Or are you at university? All these certain things that people already have an idea.
Mm-hmm.
So is that something that you set out to go, right, I'm going to make sure this is truthful, whether it's for middle-aged Edinburgh couples or for people with experience?
Yeah, definitely. I think that I felt a great sense of responsibility making something about this topic.
Yeah.
Even though I've worked in the industry, even though I participate actively in activism around sex worker rights, I still felt, like a huge weight of responsibility when making it. Because of that, like, I was very conscious that I was like adding to a conversation.
Yes.
So I did want it to be authentic. And when I was writing it, I wanted it to be for dancers. So
yes.
I always had that in my mind that, like, obviously other people come and watch it and they'll take things away from it. But if I'm writing it for my like best mates at work,
yes,
then hopefully that'll be the best way to write it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Because of course, everyone still, even if you've done something, you have a subjective experience of it. You're not saying I understand everyone's experience of it.
Absolutely not. Yeah.
No. With stripping, what are the most boring things that people ask if they find out that you have been or you are a stripper? You know, if you meet someone at a party, what are the boring things that people say or ask?
Oh God, there's like such a long list, but I guess. And it's so many different things. And I think that's why it's so difficult. I found it when I first started telling people, because it would be these like landmines of like conversations. Because
yes.
I don't know, like I'd tell someone who is like a really close mate who I'd expect to be like, oh my God, no way. Tell me all the juicy goss.
Yeah.
And she just sort of politely nodded and was like, okay, that's nice. And then moved the conversation.
Well, as in, and was that reticence because she didn't want to say the wrong thing, or do you think it was just like, that's not particularly interesting?
I think she was being polite and wanted me to just, we had a conversation about it later and she was like, oh, I didn't want to pry.
Yeah.
And I wanted you to just tell me whatever you wanted to, which retrospectively is incredibly nice.
Yes.
And then I guess other things that people say are, I guess they start to pry, which seems sometimes a bit uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Like, I guess with like another kind of job, people wouldn't.
Yeah. I think anything to do with sex, people think you're going to really love to talk about sex and sexy things.
Yeah.
There's this presumption of like, great. So like, I think sometimes trans people get this experience where people think they can talk about their genitals.
Oh my God, so true.
Yeah. Because people go like, oh, great. So what have you got?
I have this similar experience with stripping as well as with like queerness. So if somebody like finds out that I've been a stripper, then they'll tell me something that they've done, which is kind of similar. So they're like, I gave my boyfriend a lap dance once.
Ah.
Or like, they start to tell you these kind of like sex worky type things that they may have done. Or or like move the conversation in a sexual direction. That's so true.
Yeah.
And then the same thing, I think
sometimes it must come from people want to share it, but also maybe that's their way of going, I absolutely do not judge that. Maybe they go, so here's what's similar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that the... And then on the sort of, like, more difficult end of a conversation is, I guess, with other women who that doesn't agree with their feminism in some way.
Yes. Yeah.
And they see it as like a personal assault on them if anybody is a sex worker.
It's very interesting, isn't it, that some women who think society needs to change in the treatment of women blame women who sell erotic capital in any kind of sense for how they're treated, as if they're the people doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very nonsensical, but a little bit like people who kind of blame immigration for them not having a very good job.
Yeah.
The narrative makes sense to them. Like, oh, if that woman... Do you remember, like, with the Grid girls, when they cancelled all of the women that were working in Lycra at racing tracks? And the whole idea was, well, if some women are in Lycra, then other women are going to get touched up on the bus.
Yeah.
Like, as if those two things are kind of cause and effect.
Oh, my God. And this is what was such a whirlwind about when I started working in a strip club. I felt like I'd, like... pulled the curtain back on The Wizard of Oz and like had my mind blown, you know, that all of these things I thought about the world were untrue, because I would have felt so much safer working in a strip club than I did walking down the street afterwards to like go home.
Wow, that's so fascinating. So can I go back to ask you then? So what did you think? So before you ever worked in a strip club, What were your opinions? What was your worldview around that kind of thing?
Well, this is the thing, is that I think that it's something I didn't think about much. And so any opinions that I did have were so kind of absorbed through the world. I never had any conscious conversations to like formulate an opinion. It was I just absorbed the kind of like debris of what the world was saying. And like, my opinion was that people worked there because they were desperate and they had nothing else to offer as people, that they weren't like smart or that they, you know, all of these things. I think, if I was being honest with myself, that nobody like wanted to work there, and then it would be like, and the people wouldn't be interesting or, and like, it couldn't be further from the truth.
Yeah.
You know, I met so many amazing people what were like, so powerful, you know, in control of their own erotic capital in a way which I found so impressive and amazing and cool. And people who were doing so many different things with their lives and I was just so amazed at how amazing these women were, basically.
So that was the biggest surprise to you? It was like, oh, wow, these incredible, fully rounded people doing this job.
Yeah.
And I guess you just hadn't thought past that. They take their clothes off or... the dancing. Did you go and watch strippers before you did it, actually?
Only once. I went in because I like lived near one, and I was like, I'll go in and buy it was a pub, it was Pound in the Pint Jar place.
Okay.
And so I just popped in, and I was so broke at the time, I bought like half a lager because that was like the only drink I could afford, and I stood there and there was like 50 men in suits like watching these girls on stage. Wow. And I just felt so like I shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
This was like an environment that was not for me in any way.
Yeah.
And people were looking at me like, what's this person doing here? But then I like watched the girls dancing, and I thought they were so beautiful.
Yeah.
And there was this really, and I'm not saying this is so stupid that I thought this, but what I thought was like, oh, wow, if these like astonishingly beautiful women work here, then this must be a nice place to work.
Yeah. It kind of legitimizes it.
Yeah. In some way, which I think is like, yeah, obviously so.
No, I think we're a very superficial species. We can't help it. When we see good-looking, attractive people doing things, we like those things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And everyone was so nice. I like sat down and like spoke to some girls, and they gave me some advice of like how to audition and things like that. And I just thought it was like warm and welcoming and nice. I'm sure that's not everybody's experience, but it was mine.
Well, that's one of the interesting things about so stripping, like lots of kinds of sex work, there are people who don't do it anymore, who seem to have had an experience where they retrospectively change their minds or they look at it differently. So say, this is a made up example, but say there was a woman who was 20, 21, 22 and did stripping, and then maybe has children, and then in her 40s goes, I feel exploited by that experience. But at the time, I felt it was the only thing open to me, or obviously like in any job, but particularly a job where you might be alone with a man or a drunk man or a man who thinks he has certain rights to your body, like people do have negative experiences. And I guess those can haunt people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. But I think that can be said of so many types of work. And
yes.
I think that where that conversation becomes unhelpful is like when it clouds the things that the women currently working in the industry want and need.
Yes.
And so I think everybody's experience of the industry is their experience. Mm. And I'm sure that that's incredibly varied, like people's experience of working lots of different types of work.
Absolutely.
And I think that's dependent on so many things. And I think that nobody can take that away from you. If that's your experience and your opinion, then it's not my business or your business to tell them that's wrong. But I think that when that becomes public discussion, we so often are ready to like use our emotional reaction about what we feel about sex work to want it to be extinguished, I think, so often.
Yeah.
And we aren't listening to the people who work in the industry.
Yeah.
And as far as I'm concerned, I think that's all that matters, you know? So like if the people working in the industry say sex work is work, then sex work is work.
Yeah.
And if sex workers want decrim,
yes,
let's give them decrim.
Yes.
And if sex workers want their strip clubs to stay open, let's keep them open.
Yeah.
And if sex workers want, you know, the licenses to be owned by managers, not venues, or venues, not managers, if people want to run their own venues, if they want more venues to be open so they have more choice of where to go and to leave exploitative club owners, then let's give them that. I think that that's not, that's like where we go wrong so often in our wanting to help and our allyship.
Oh, yes. I think there's a lots of very destructive things that can come from quite a good place in people wanting to protect, in particular, women. I absolutely agree with you. So that's very interesting. So in terms of kind of the clubs and the managers and who owns and who earns the money, is this a kind of means of production thing where people should be allowed to be more in control of their working environment?
Yeah, because there's this interesting thing that's happened where strippers have workers' rights because by law they are legally workers.
Yeah. Are they self-employed?
Well,
depending
on what club you work at,
okay,
by law, if an external lawyer was come in and to ask questions about like how you book your shifts, or what you're told what you can and can't wear, and like who you have to report to and stuff, some people would be qualified as employees and other people would be self-employed workers. But the clubs don't treat the girls with these kind of like workers. They're not given their rights, basically. So for example, in every strip club, I think, you have to pay to work there. So you have to pay a house fee.
And that's regardless of what you earn, and it doesn't go up or down? Or does it go up at weekends and things?
It's completely different to every club. So like some clubs will have like an afternoon shift fee, an evening fee, weekend fee, different.
Okay.
You know, some people, places you do pay half the first time you work there. It's like they just decide. And sometimes they'll give people a cut on their house fee if they've been there for a long time or they like them, or, you know, it's absolutely up to the discretion of the club. There's like no regulation whatsoever.
Okay. Yes.
And then you're fined for things like they can fine you for anything. So for like being late, cancelling a shift, people withhold payment, you know,
God.
And these are people who are workers and have workers' rights, which aren't being respected.
No.
And so this is where the problem is. So the thing is, if like you want to help, and there's this like funny thing that happens where all the decisions are made over the heads of the women that it affects.
Yes.
And they are usually mostly women.
Yeah.
And so, for example, with the council, they make regulations around things like around things like physical touch and what you're allowed to wear at work.
The council make the rules on that, not the club.
Well, the club enforce the rules, but there are rules made by the council which the club have to enforce.
Okay. In terms of like the type of club it is.
Yeah, so in the UK there's no physical contact between girls and customers.
Yes.
And that's the law that the council have made, and they come into clubs and speak to the managers to make how, like, to make decisions on what needs to change, yeah. and they don't speak to the girls.
No.
And so often, if you know what I mean, and so yes. often, like, laws and legislations and things, and feminist groups who yes. want to, like, yeah. help aren't mm. speaking directly to the women that it affects.
Yeah.
They're just completely, like, crossed out, and their opinion is discredited because they're seen as people that are, like, potentially coerced or broken victims or something.
Yeah, which is quite often the argument when, especially if it disagrees with feminism, that's mm-hmm. what has to happen. It's like, oh, well, actually, you've been brainwashed
yeah.
by the patriarchy, or you, yeah. So that, so suddenly your argument is devalued.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So do you think in those situations, so if the workers were to be asked, they would have completely different needs or requirements?
Yeah, because the way that it works at the moment is that a lot of the power is in the management's hands. Mm. So they're controlling how many girls they put on a shift.
Yes.
And so if they get £100 house fee, for example, from the girls, they're making loads of money off having girls there.
Yes.
So they're happy to, like, fill the club with girls and not put on an amount of girls which is useful to everyone making money.
Yes.
You know? And there's often, like, unfairness and favouritism with shift booking.
Yeah.
They can fire people for any reason because they're not technically employed.
Yes. Yeah.
And so there's all this stuff that goes on, which means you have, like, a high job insecurity, high competitiveness at work, which isn't doesn't make it a fun place to work.
No, it's not conducive.
The being naked, and it's not the work itself, right?
Yeah.
It's the way that we're being managed at the
yes.
clubs.
Yeah.
And if it was managed differently, they could be, like, really great places to work.
Yes.
Because you have, like, the freedom to earn money, and
yes.
that's, like, when people's rights are respected and they have agency at work
yeah.
and you're earning money, that's really empowering.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So I was reading a book about, so it was written, I think it was essays written by people still stripping and people. And the thing that I hadn't ever realised, I find lots of correlations with being a stand-up comedian, because the same things in terms of, you can be fired, someone can choose not to book you, there's favouritism, all these kind of things are all exactly the same. There's also a fair amount of hustling, but not in the same way in terms of approaching customers, but in terms of promoters and bookers, there's this whole kind of people who are slightly more powerful, even though we are the people on stage who actually do the job. But what I thought was so interesting was this thing about, from a club manager's perspective, even without taking the kind of the fee that they might get into consideration, having lots and lots of women makes their club look amazing, because for a customer, there's lots of choice, and they might feel like, oh, my, there's five women to every one of me. I'm so lucky. But at the same time, the less money that the workers are earning or whatever they're trying to earn that night or for that week, that's how people are pressurized into doing, taking maybe jobs. Job isn't the right word, but things that you don't want to do.
Or, yeah.
So when you have agency, when you know you're earning great money that night, when someone comes along that you don't want to spend any time with, you can say no.
Mm.
Whereas I guess when you're thinking, I haven't even made back my £100 yet, annoying people, drunk people, handsy people, basically you always make a worker more vulnerable. If vulnerable is not the right word, pressurized.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, depending on, that's it. You're then having to, sometimes people end up bending the rules of the club or bending their own personal boundaries or whatever. So,
yeah,
and I think that needn't be like that
yes.
in that particular industry.
Yeah.
Because it could be, there's enough to go around. Mm. And if everybody was, felt a bit more secure and was earning a little bit more, then they'd be having more fun, and they'd be
yes.
and they'd be, like, funner places to walk into, even if there aren't five guys to one girl.
Yes.
If everybody there is, like, feeling, having a good time,
yes,
then I think that sounds like more fun to me. Personally.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. But I guess that's a conversation all throughout capitalism, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Is that if there's someone at the top who is going to make more money but make their workers less happy, obviously when money is the most important thing to the whole setup, I guess, so what would you say, there should be better legislation around strip clubs?
No, I think that all the dancers should join our union.
Oh, so you have a union?
Yeah.
How does that work?
They're called the UVW. They are United Voices of the World, and they are a union which represent lots of precarious workers.
Okay.
So they represent cleaners and security and also strippers now. And they're currently working towards getting more and more girls in the union, because when we have a union and we hold the majority in clubs, we then have the power to request these things that we want.
Yeah.
Like if we, I don't know, things like uniform, choose the freedom to choose what you wear, how booking shifts work, how many girls are on shift.
Yeah.
And I think that if we all... I think the union really has the power to keep our clubs open and working in a way which like benefits us and provide us with some job security.
Yeah, so, amazing. So to act as a kind of a communication between the two. And so that's interesting to me, because we tried to set up a comedians union. And actually what happens, so Equity, which is the actors union, technically represents comedians as well, but comedians won't join. And there have been a couple of problems in terms of people not getting paid. And as in like big club chains, then suddenly stopping paying people. And what you would think is that everyone would stop working for that company. But there are almost so many comedians, there'll always be someone who works. So actually, comedians' wages haven't gone up in 20 years. In like the, so the Comedy Store still pays what they paid 15, 20 years ago. Yeah, the union, it just, people were so set up for themselves as individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And their biggest worry is not getting booked. Because it, all of the power is in bookers' hands.
Of course, and that is a fear. And you know, the unionisation process is still in its like early stages. Mm. It's something which hasn't only been started semi-recently. And I think that that is the fear, that people don't want to rock the boat because something's working for them, and people really don't want to lose their jobs. They don't want to lose their income. Mm. They don't want to get fired. And they don't want to hurt the clubs. Some people see themselves... as if they demand these things that the union speaks about, that it might hurt the club in some way.
Yeah.
And there's this kind of like loyalty there. But I think change is difficult. And I think if we're patient, then like we're always more stronger together.
Yes.
And I think it's, and it's the same with comedians and stuff. Like you are some people's bread and butter, right?
Yes.
And I think people just need to recognize their power.
Yes.
And I think that with comedians, with artists, you know, I experienced this as well as like a freelance artist, where it's hard to recognize your value when so many people recognize your work as something that you're meant to enjoy, or as an elective career. You know, like me being an artist, or you being a comedian is an elective kind of career. And so asking for money feels like rude, or like demanding more money seems like vulgar in some way.
Yeah, it's definitely seen as vulgar rather than as a sign of strength and knowing your worth. It's seen as like, oh God, you just like money. It's like, I really like it. I'm not the only one.
But it's like valuing yourself, isn't it? And that's the thing, is that, I think it's really powerful when people begin to recognise their value.
Yes. I think it's always in the kind of employer's interest, no matter what kind of variety they take, but undervaluing people, telling them you're replaceable. So if you won't do the job for us, we'll go somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
That's across all of the things that we're talking about, is that's how the money stays small.
Yeah.
It's them going, well, if you won't do it for this, so that hundreds of people will.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's the economic pressure.
Yeah, definitely. I think that, and I think that we all should have a bit more kindness towards each other when we're trying to like survive under capitalism, and recognise it's something that's like oppressing all of us, and not stoke the fires of this belief that this is just the way things are.
Oh, yeah.
Things can't change. Mm. And the scarcity mentality, I think, is what sucks, you know.
Yeah.
It sucks at the strip club, it sucks as an artist or as a comedian. You know, it doesn't create kind of like camaraderie and like love and enthusiasm and creativity. When there's a scarcity mentality, it's like everyone for themselves.
Yes.
And I think it has an effect on the work that we do as know.
Absolutely. And in Jenna Jameson's autobiography, have you read it?
No.
So it's a really funny book. It's really interesting. And so she, while doing porn, was doing actually, I can't remember the timeline. She definitely stripped for a long time and then was going back to strip clubs and doing kind of PA appearances after she'd been doing porn. And so she was absolutely... She must have been a stripper first because she has a thing in there about common stripper injuries, which is really interesting, which is done as like a cartoon, just in terms of things about basically just holding your body in a certain way in heels has its own particular injuries or aches and pains and things that you have to deal with. She was such a businesswoman. She was such a hustler, and she definitely wasn't there to make friends. And I guess that's the thing about a scarcity attitude, is that that can come out of certain people. But then also, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. I just wondered if you'd read it.
No.
No.
But,
yeah. I mean, she sounds like an absolute bitch, is what I mean.
I like the callback. The cartoon is a kind of like callback to the beginning of our conversation.
Yes.
We were talking about, you were saying how people, my show may have been something which is refreshing for people from the community to see, because it was authentic or like from the voice of somebody who'd worked there. And I wanted to say at the time was that another place for that has always been recently is Instagram.
Oh, yeah.
So like the internet is a place where our community meets each other and creates through like memes or tweets or stories or blog posts, or like the internet has been this space of... like just being seen, this like beautiful place, which I think full of like comfort and camaraderie and like no stigma and no shame.
Yeah.
And there's like, there was, I don't know, it's probably been deleted now, which is very sad, but there was this beautiful Tumblr, which is like stripper locker room selfies.
Yeah.
And it was just this like huge library of people taking selfies in their locker rooms.
So people all over the world could see other people doing their job.
Yeah.
Like, and you're me there and you're me over there.
Yeah. And like in jokes and people, you know, giving people advice or support or whatever in the comments sections.
Yes.
And and it's a really scary time, actually, because I guess we're moving into an age where there are certain people controlling what we can and can't see online.
Yes.
And those who are considered not suitable for the online space, such as sex workers, are going to have that taken away.
Yeah, and I think that's it. The internet was so freeing because there weren't any rules, because no one knew what it was going to be. So there wasn't kind of a guidebook. It has been so incredibly leveling for all subcultures. It doesn't matter if you've got a kink for a certain sex thing, or if you're really into reading James Joyce, you can find a community of people who are just as passionate as you are, and then have a discussion with them. But I think you're absolutely right, people are now going to try and limit that, because, and also it always comes from this thing of thinking it's negative for children. Whereas the most exciting thing is that now children who grow up, especially if they're not in a big city, can find people who make them feel completely normal.
Absolutely. Because, there may have been a time, but, before the internet, you may have been, like, the only trans person that you knew.
Yeah. Or and not even know trans was a thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, you know, in terms of queerness, with being trans, with doing these certain types of work or facing these certain types of stigma, I think it's just this, like, beautiful... Yeah, the internet has been really giving in that way of, like, connecting people.
Yeah.
But it's also... it definitely makes, I think, these groups also feel very, like, persecuted and excluded when they are literally excluded from the internet, which is, like, the other world that we live in, you know?
Just taken away. And I think we don't take it seriously because we think, well, that's not real life. You're not being put in prison. But actually, if that's your lifeline, your communication, also what the establishment is saying when they do that, when they say, oh, there's been a nipple or you've used a word, when they take everything away and people lose all of their followers and everything that's set up, I think it's too easy to be dismissive of what that can actually, the ramifications to somebody's life.
Yeah, not just for the person whose account that is, but for the people who followed it, you know, like those, I think that, like certain pockets of community, this is a lifeline for some people, you know. I'm not saying for like all strippers' Instagram accounts are, but for certain areas of the internet, for someone, that was like an important thing that they could read on their phone at work or... at home or whatever.
It is an odd thing, or maybe it's not an odd thing, but if something involves nudity, not even necessarily female nudity actually, but the assumption is it doesn't have any worth, that it's either there to titillate. I think, so me before researching and writing my book, in terms of, you know, like you said earlier, like not having thought about it a lot, but would have had a knee-jerk opinion.
Mm.
I remember that there was this organisation called Femen.
Just interrupting the podcast here to clarify that I'm referencing Femen, a Ukrainian radical feminist activist group intended to protect women's rights. They got a lot of coverage in the media and newspapers because they took their clothes off.
And they were topless, and you probably know about them. And so they were Europeans, but they came to London and they had their tops off and they were drawing flowers on their boobs, and they all had really incredible boobs. So it wasn't like just bodies. These were very modelly looking white women with flowers on their boobs. And I remember thinking, no one will ever take you seriously with your top off. Mm-hmm. No one will ever take you seriously. We don't go into business meetings going, let's take our bras off so they really listen. And I did. I had this knee-jerk reaction. And one of the things that's been very interesting about following lots of people on Instagram is people who take their clothes off for a living on Instagram is that they are the most politicized accounts I follow. Yeah. And so it has been really interesting. And because it doesn't matter if someone's posing in a thong, because the commentary underneath and the discussion that they're having, or they're angry about that day, or all those kind of things. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that... we're really fighting for freedom to express ourselves in the way that we use our bodies, in however the way that we want. Mm. Do you know what I mean? And I think that goes in so many different directions.
Yeah.
And I think that that freedom to dress in a certain way or express your femininity in a certain way or not.
Yeah,
is what is beautiful. And I think it's like affronting to people.
All of us, no matter how we grew up, we imbibe certain messages. And actually the exciting part of adulthood should be deconstructing them, working out for anyone, no matter what they believe, working out where they came from, what you do agree with, why you have it. And that's why it's really good to be confronted. It's a really healthy thing to go, oh, I had an emotional reaction to that. Why?
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe sometimes we trust the emotional reaction. So something that's interesting to me is so this is different to women trying to control other women. But I think it's something that's quite common, is like women being jealous. So say, for instance, stag do's tend to go to strip clubs, and it's quite often men who don't usually go to strip clubs. So they don't have a relationship where, like, this is how I socialise, this is where I go with my friends. So there'll be a heterosexual woman who's got a male partner who then has been to a strip club, and she, this has never happened to me, by the way, this isn't like my bugbear, but it's something that's happened to friends. She suddenly feels very jealous because she doesn't actually know what that interaction was like. She doesn't know whether he was aroused, whether he's now looking. I think women sometimes can, maybe it's not even a female thing, their insecurity can then be, you've seen all these beautiful people now who seem sexually available to you, and now I seem dowdy in comparison. Those kind of things. It means that stripping can be confronting just because it exists. And they think their emotional reaction is right, as in it shouldn't happen. Mm-hmm. People shouldn't go. That's quite an interesting area.
Yeah. I think it's a funny one. There's like a great meme where, like, saying thinking a stripper's going to steal your husband is like thinking your babysitter's going to want to steal your kids.
Yeah.
Can't wait to give them back to you.
Yeah. And then literally you're paying them to be there.
So it's like, yeah. And I think also what's interesting is that, I guess what that says to me is that there are lots of taboos around sex, especially in, I guess, heterosexual and like monogamous relationships. Because I guess, I don't know, I guess in my experience anyway, with like in queer communities, nothing's a given.
Yes.
So you have to talk about things more. There's not this like set of like, yes, this kind of thing you've been handed down, this rule.
Calling
book.
It a given is exactly the thing. I think heterosexual narrative is always that other person's sexuality only goes towards you. Mm-hmm. And if it goes anywhere else, that's a failed monogamous relationship. So it's a real misunderstanding of monogamy and of sexuality.
Mm.
And I think that's when it becomes confronted. Some people struggle when their partner watches pornography for exactly the same reason. Like, they've failed rather than like, no, not all sexuality, or not all of their arousal is for you.
And I think it's a great shame that you can't share those conversations with each other, because I think that's incredibly freeing, you know, to talk about your sexual life not as being intrinsically linked to the other person, you know. There might be like a variety of things that like arouse you or you find exciting, and I think that's a beautiful thing to be able to share with someone else, even if you are in a monogamous relationship, and it probably takes the like anxiety and fear out of those things which are like seen as transgressions.
Also, I think intimacy is created through honesty and truthfulness, and I think the difficulty is that people setting up relationships with a pretend kind of intimacy because they're hiding bits of themselves they think won't be accepted or that they can't explore. This is all throwbacks to like we're growing out as a society of kind of religious oppression, where obviously there wasn't all of this encouragement for people to explore their sexuality. It was no, get married, don't do anything else.
And I was it was interesting because I was reading your book and I was thinking about how like paternity certainty linked to capitalism. And I was thinking about how it is interesting how marriage, for example, or like monogamy is a convenient like one way system usually, because there is that thing like, oh, boys will be boys and they have to get around a bit. And but for women, there's this important thing about like virginity and marriage and all of this stuff. And how I guess all of these religious institutions that are historical have been set up to ensure that like women don't get about and men do.
Absolutely, yeah.
But I guess now there's this kind of like equal expectations of partners to be like faithful, not only literally, but even in their minds.
Yes.
You know, don't even look at someone else or think about someone else. And but then there's no conversation, and it just seems like an unrealistic expectation and a lot of pressure for people to put on themselves.
And I think people think they're failing, and they think that relationships are failing rather than that the expectations are completely unnatural. I've been thinking a lot. I'm not married and I'll never get married, but as marriage as a form of transactional sex, it's the biggest, it's the most common form of transactional sex, because and still now in certain cultures and countries, but especially it used to be in this country 150 years ago, if women aren't able to earn money, they literally needed to exchange their body, their fertility and their sex with someone who could. So the whole system was set up is that you had to be, someone had to like you enough to want to keep you alive, like other than your family, and that we don't see it that way. That's seen as being unromantic, but no one was marrying for love. Like that they were very lucky. It wasn't everyone was.
And that's why I think it's so important, you know, especially in an industry like stripping, for example, where it employs women.
Yes.
Protecting those women's jobs is important, because it's still, we still live in a world where there's a wage gap, and it's harder to earn money as a woman.
And also flexible jobs, because the other thing is that women who want to or do have family commitments or educational commitments, the idea that like, no, what you're not allowed to do is earn a lot of money twice a week.
Yeah,
it has to be your entire life.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, it's important that feminism doesn't just focus on like white middle class people and getting like female CEOs on boards. Like, I don't really care about that. I think that feminism needs to be focusing on like the other end, and like looking at working class women and how they can be supported to have their jobs protected and earn more. And I think that's our real responsibility. And like, I don't even know if it is feminism if it only focuses on white middle class women.
No, I think this is the thing about being white and middle class, which I am, is that we have the most privilege, and so we're the most vocal and the most heard. And this is brilliant Michael Frayn quote from the 70s. He was talking about spitting image, and they were saying about how satire was really kind of brilliant in terms of being so anti-politics, and he said, beware anyone's voice you hear within a system, because if you can hear them, it means the system is working for them. And I think that's the thing, and that's not to criticise anyone's work within feminism, but it is a failure that you're being successful at it because actually everything's working for you.
And
it does have to shift, and it does need to get better, not only at listening to other women, but creating a platform where they are heard. And that's what that does need to improve. Because also you can't talk on people's behalf. You can't go,
And I think it's especially important that the movement includes like trans women and migrant women and sex workers. And I think if you're serving those people, then you're likely to serve other people in the process, you know?
Yeah. And it's interesting because also those three groups, that so intersects with kind of economics and the different choices available to people who have. I was really surprised by the act of coming out as trans is so related to unemployment and homelessness because you are rejected by what would in society be your safety network. People, the rate of people losing their jobs after mm-hmm. coming out as trans and those kind of things.
Yeah.
So you're literally disempowered because you don't have a way to earn a living, which then obviously relates to how you pay your rent. And then if also you don't have a supportive family, people become instantly so vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. And so I think that, it's definitely important to not only never exclude, but like be active allies of those groups.
Yes.
And
so if anyone was listening and thinking, okay, I really want to do that. How, Jo? How do I do it?
Well, I think that one of the things that I found so nice to read in your book is that this like ongoing process of discovery and that you were open-minded and willing to change your opinion and to acknowledge that if you have an emotional reaction to something, that doesn't necessarily mean that that's right or the truth or useful.
Yeah.
And I think that good allyship is listening to the groups that you want to help and supporting them in the way that they say, not in the way that you think should be done.
Yeah, that's the difficulty with the binary argument. And it's actually interesting because you said it earlier, the difference between exited sex workers and people who are currently working in sex work, their needs are different.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not to deny an experience, but it can't be led by people who have exited. It has to be people who are currently still, that's how they're surviving.
And sometimes those people are being used. You know, a group who wants to lobby against sex workers will find a person who has exited the industry and had a negative experience and use them.
Mm.
And
that's what's so interesting about Linda Lovelace. Linda Lovelace was an American porn actor, one of the most famous of all time because she starred in the 1972 hardcore film Deep Throat. She later wrote a book called Ordeal about her experience in the porn industry with accusations of coercion. Who's someone I knew nothing about, but so she had this horrible experience in porn that she then wrote about in a book, Ordeal, and then she was exactly like that. She was commandeered by Andrea Dworkin and Catherine McKinnon. She was the woman from the inside talking about how awful the porn industry mm-hmm. was to women. And then she then said... the feminists were worse to me than porn.
Yeah.
Because she felt very used. And I'm not saying that's absolutely everyone, but it's interesting, isn't it? That
feminists are a really powerful ally, right? So I think that what's so interesting is that in a world where they see the women working in those industries as not qualifying to give an opinion on their state of affairs, so then they deter to other women because, like, men are seen as, like, customers and perverts and stuff. And I think that there are lots of men that feel anxious about coming out in support of, like, sex worker rights because they're like, I don't want to be seen
as predatory. Someone's just like a little...
I only support it because I want to consume it.
Yeah.
Not because I actually believe that this is right.
It's true, actually. I hadn't even thought about how difficult it would be to set up if you were a straight man going, I just really believe in equality. I just really understand the needs here.
Yeah. Well, and some people do, because if you are participating more directly in those lines of work or you don't have that emotional reaction to it where you're like, I don't want that to happen to me, therefore I don't want it to exist, then it's possible that those people, some men are quicker to understand, possibly.
Yeah.
And so I think that, like, you know, that our feminists with power and platform and privilege are our greatest allies when it comes to sex worker rights because people look to them to give an opinion on this matter.
Yeah.
And so I think it's so important that they read, listen, you know, get involved in the conversation and like read about it and listen to the opinions of sex workers, read Revolting Prostitutes, an amazing book, And I think
that really is an amazing book, isn't it?
It is.
I say amazing because it's very readable, and some books that are academic aren't.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's kind of a textbook in terms that it includes, it seems just so incredibly well researched across everything,
yeah.
like explaining the economics underneath a system without the morality, and kind of every argument that people will have heard against certain things or certain people, or what about this? They just deconstruct it so beautifully.
Yeah, and yeah. I found it so fascinating as a book because it made me understand the world that I live in more, and not just from not just about sex work, you know,
yes.
about economics, about capitalism, about migration,
yes. yeah.
about so much stuff. It's just really a wonderful read, which has definitely left me.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing. So maybe if you're listening and you went out and did something like that, like bought Revolting Prostitutes, and then you'll be able to start conversations with people. I've just found out this fact about migrant workers, and you can discuss it with the people around you, and even that in itself, thinking about things from a completely different way with a new set of information.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think it's brilliant because like knowledge is power, and I think also you lift people up when you listen to them and platform their work, right?
Yeah.
So like listening to sex workers by, you know, buying their book, listening to them, they've got, you know, there are so many blogs and they're writing articles and writing their own books and just doing so much stuff. There's like so much out there. So you can go and find it and consume it and support them and platform them and shout about them because they're just fucking switched on people that have had to really fight to be heard because of this thing that you said earlier where you felt how no one's going to be taken seriously with their top off.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that they've been confronted with that opinion.
Yeah. Well, actually, something I was going to say to you is that, so I know two people who've kind of, two of my friends who used to strip and have always worried of like keeping it secret years later. And it's something I've been thinking about a lot because one of them, I think her worry is much more that she's quite powerful now, that she'll be gossiped about, as in the idea if you tell one person, suddenly everyone knows because it's this salacious little detail. And the other one, I think it's much more about, but both of them feel that they will lose something that's so part of their history that made them who they are actually in lots and lots of ways, and how they understand the world, how they understand men actually has been quite shaped by their jobs, but they still feel they'll be slightly discredited just because they... Yeah, danced.
Of course, I think that that's like, you know, the concern for so many people. And I think that loads of people don't have the privilege to be out for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Because they have loads of other pressures on them and they can't afford to lose whatever it is that you lose withouting yourself, right?
Yeah.
And I think that not being out as a sex worker is completely legitimate.
Yeah.
And if you don't want to do that, that's completely up to you. And I think that nobody should be putting the pressure on anyone to be out about what they do.
No.
I think that is like completely up to you. And I think that people should have agency over what they disclose about their own lives in that way.
Absolutely.
However, there are people who are out about what they do and it's really cool. And it's like sets a community on fire, you know, like Cardi B is a kind of icon because she not only admits to having worked in a strip club as part of her narrative, she owns it. She like recreates really powerful, empowering imagery of strippers in her like videos and songs and stuff. And it's really cool.
Yeah,
you
it's
know?
Brilliant.
So that's like, means a lot to a lot of people.
Yeah, but also for some people, that she might be an absolute game changer in terms of the narrative they thought of it, if it's something they have no experience of. So I wanted to ask you about your Brazilian nights and the kind of the brilliant stuff that you're doing in terms of...
So we've got one coming up now, which will... This podcast is going to come out later,
so we
would have missed one, but hopefully there'll be another one in
but
the pipeline.
But people could follow on Twitter and stuff if they wanted to keep up to date with future...
If you want to keep up with the show, Fuck You Pay Me, or Brazilian Wax, which is our big party, you can follow us on FYPM Show on Twitter or FYPM.show on Instagram because we got deleted.
Oh, did you get deleted?
Yeah, we did. Our Instagram account got deleted a couple of months ago, just before we were going to start this big run of the show.
And do you get like an email to tell you why? Or is it just gone?
No, it's just gone. You try and log in and it's gone. So like all the messages, all the contacts, all the photos, everything is just gone.
Yeah.
Which is sad. But it's fine. It happens.
Yeah.
So you can follow us there. And Brazilian Wax is a night that we started in the beginning to like raise money for the show.
Yeah.
So I started making this when I started making the show, when I did a sort of scratch reading of it, which was supported by an R&D I did at with Brainchild, which is an organisation and a platform Southwark. And there was such a positive kind of community response that we were like, we've got to carry this on.
Brilliant.
So we started doing these nights at the Bethnal Green Working Men's Club.
Oh, yeah.
And they're called Brazilian Wax, and they're sort of like big queer Latin off-duty sex worker parties is the kind of idea. So we have a cabaret of performers that we program, and we have Brazilian music all night.
Yeah.
And we also run a pop-up strip club, which at this party is going to be run by the UVW, the Strippers Union.
Yeah.
So everybody working in the tiny pop-up strip club, which is literally just made out of fabric in like the corner of the Bethnal Green Working Men's Club, is going to be run by dancers who are all members of the union.
Yeah.
And they're going to be donating 50% of their earnings to the union.
Yeah.
And they're going to put it all in a pot. So it's going to be the first kind of like co-op run pop-up strip club endeavour of all time.
Of all time. Yeah, amazing. So, is that a feasible solution for the future? Solution to the, is that more strippers will own strip clubs?
I don't know if that's, I don't know. I think it would just be nicer or better if like people who are already running strip clubs or want to run strip clubs in the future just listen to the people who are working and just ran them in a way which suited them.
Yeah. What about customers? So like people who go to strip clubs, is there a way that they can positively help?
Yeah, don't try and negotiate your fees. Just pay what you've been asked to be like.
Do what you're told.
Yeah, be a nice customer.
Yeah.
It's like any service industry, right? Don't like be courteous, polite. Don't try and push boundaries and pay properly and tip. And that's it, basically.
Yeah.
I think it's a no-brainer when you stop to compare it to like other kind of like,
it's exactly
service
the
industry
same.
Jobs. So I think, and but there are some strip clubs that are being run by strippers and ex-dancers and stuff, especially in the States.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's a documentary about one.
Mm.
And I think Amber Rose, who used to be a stripper,
bought
a strip club.
Yeah.
So I think it definitely is happening.
Great. Hey, thank you so much for talking to me.
Okay.
Good luck with everything.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. This has been Sex, Power, Money with me, Sarah Pascoe. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please recommend it to your friends. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and give us a 5-star review so that other people can find it. Sex, Power, Money is also the name of my book that's sometimes been mentioned in the podcast. I'd love you to read it if you'd like to find out more and have your own discussions with your friends. Thank you so much to Joanna Nastery. Please seek her out online if you can't get to see her show, Fuck You Pay Me. She's on Twitter at Joanna Nastery. And also, if you're based near London, check out one of her Brazilian wax parties. They sound absolutely amazing. Next week, I'll be joined by Nikki and Laura from the English Collective of Prostitutes. See you then.